And our text today that will help to illumine that way through our message comparing religions today. Let me just reread for the sake of our website the text from John 14, 1 to 7. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. On April 5th, 1994, Kurt Cobain, lead singer of the band Nirvana, committed suicide in Seattle with a shotgun under his chin. He had been diagnosed as suicidal months previous. He'd been found with numerous guns and drugs, struggled with depression and trauma. He'd even had a major intervention in his life, as they call it, where 10 of his closest friends, his wife Courtney Love, lovingly confronted him with his downward spiral, all to no avail. Any Nirvana fans in here? Maybe that was in your past life, perhaps. One of the cutting-edge grunge bands from the 90s. Police found him in his room with a note addressed to his imaginary childhood friend, Boda, which was his childhood pronunciation of Buddha. Now, Nirvana is a Sanskrit word meaning extinction, literally. It describes the blissful state of existence in which one overcomes the three unwholesome roots of life, that is, desire, hatred, and delusion, and the being stops willing altogether. In doing this, one escapes the determining effects of karma, another word that we hear often in our culture but don't really understand as the Buddhists express it. That, of course, is one's good or ill deeds returned to him in this or a future life in an endless cycle, unless one is somehow delivered. But unlike the Buddhist monk who comes to understand and aspire to this state of being, Nirvana, Cobain selected the name Nirvana for his band after watching a late-night documentary on Buddhism. How so many Americans get their information, isn't it? In the song Come As You Are, he indicates this too. He unfolds how they came to this name, rejecting all of the evil Satanist-type name bands, which were all adopting Satan. That was the current at the time. So I guess there's some value to this. Nirvana sounded nice to him, though, and represented a strange, exotic, and blissful state of being that went well with the drugs and the rock and roll of their grunge culture, but which any Buddhist monk would reject out of hand, right? Now, Cobain represents emblematically the shallow dabbling that characterizes American experience of religion. Cobain never lifted a finger to practice true Buddhism, living a life of personal discipline that would extinguish the very passions to which he eventually succumbed. Rather, Cobain indulged those passions to write rock music and be a success, but they eventually took him. How tragic and ironic that directly opposite of Nirvana, which are the extinction of desire and the attainment of bliss, Cobain died in the throes of turbulent passion and the torture of personal agony and pain. How little we understand the religions we claim to follow, huh? Cobain had early in his life rejected Christianity. Anybody that knows his biography, he had a brief spate of born-againism, as he called it. He was living with a devout evangelical family at the time. He went to church. He knew the gospel. No one knows what drove him away, but he soon began espousing his shallow version of Eastern religion. And we'll get into this. We'll spend some time unpacking New Age religion too, which kind of cobbles together various elements of Eastern religions. Had he known the true nature of nirvana and the Christian alternative of heaven, he might have been able to stop his shallow dabbling in Eastern religions, embraced exaltation in Christ rather than extinction in Buddha. That is true joy in the living God who made us and loves us, rather than a formless bliss in nothingness. Therefore, for our contemporary culture in particular, it is advantageous to compare and contrast the religions of the world, in particular ours today, Christianity and Buddhism. Christianity and Buddhism. So, we'll spend 2 weeks. Next week, we'll look at the fruits of the religions that we compare. But today, let's look at 2 points in particular when we come to Buddhism. Number one, how do the ascended masters compare to the ascended Christ? What am I worshiping? Is one of the things that we ask. When we come to the world religions, who am I worshiping? What am I worshiping? So today we ask, how do the ascended masters compare to the ascended Christ? Now, Buddhism is one of the four major world religions with over 360 million adherents, found primarily in the East, Tibet, India, Central China, Japan. Nevertheless, Buddhism has spread in various forms to the West, to the chagrin of many of the purists of Buddhism in the East. It has spread to the West, and people like Kurt Cobain end up representing Buddhism to many Americans, and the true Buddhists in the saffron robes just shake their heads at what America has done to the religions of the East. There are various schools of Buddhism in the United States: Japanese, Taiwanese, Theravadin, Tibetan, Zen. Zen is probably one we're most familiar with in our pop culture. Each have their own distinctive features. Developed over centuries of practice as Buddhism spread all over the world. But they have broad generalities in common. Some of those generalities are ensconced in the life of Buddha. Interesting, some of it is interesting. Once again, I read most of this stuff so you don't have to, but the life of Buddha is interesting. And in the life of Buddha, we discover, for example, some of the truths and principles that they hold. For example, there is no creator God per se. Unlike the scriptures, of course, where we are confronted right in the opening of Genesis, right? In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. God created the heavens and the earth. And very crucial, very key here too, there is no infinite personal God either. No infinite personal God. There's no Immanuel principle in Buddhism. That is, I will be their God, the God of my people, and they will be my people, and I will live with them forever, dwell amongst them forever. That is an indicator. Don't take that for granted. That is an indicator that the God who made the world also desires to live with his people, to have a personal relationship, if we can coin a phrase. Right, have a personal relationship with Jesus. Well, we see this in the text that we read, right? Today, I go to prepare a place for you. I'll come back for you. You will, that where I am, you may be also. We read that these kinds of texts all the time in the Bible. But we take for granted that God desires to have a personal relationship with us, you know, to be one with us. World religions don't know this. They have no concept of it. We saw it in Islam, right? We see it now in Buddhism as well. There's no concept, no idea of a infinite personal God. In fact, in my reading, I came across one Buddhist monk. I quote him, he says, "When asked whence all things, we Buddhists smile benignly in utter silence, even as Gautama did so long ago." And there's these ironies and contradictions and so forth and silences that represent the teaching of Buddhism, because Buddhism must be experienced rather than taught. So you'll find these kinds of things all the time. When asked, where did all things come from? Who created it? Where did it all materialize from? The Buddha says, "I don't know and I don't care." But this does not mean that there is no panoply of gods. And we might postulate this, given pagan principles, the real experience of spiritual realms in every major world religion. Many of these gods, and they make a feature of Buddhism, you know, that there is no infinite personal God. There is no God per se. And that's why you'll see in many science journals a real simpatico, a real adoption by many scientists of Buddhism, because ostensibly there's no God like you find in Judaism or Christianity or Islam. But the deeper you go, the more you discover, you find out that, as in every pagan religion, there are spiritual entities out there that we might as well call gods, and they do call gods in quotation marks, however. Many of these gods are what Buddhism calls ascended masters. That is, previous Buddhas who have achieved enlightenment, even as the founder of Buddhism did in the mid-6th century B.C., Gautama Buddha says there were some 135,000 previous Buddhas in the history of the universe. The Buddhist cosmology consists of 3,000 world systems, in which there are as many as 31 levels in the heaven of the contented. This is the spiritual locale, if you will. And once again, the number of levels of the heaven of the contented varies. Gautama Buddha had a pre-existence in level 4. He was slotted right there in level 4 of the heaven of the contented. I'm being rather arbitrary in terms of slotting him in the fourth heaven, where he dwelt as bearer of the white banner. His name was Svetakatu, and he was teacher king of 300,000 gods. So you see, as you begin to dig a little deeper into Buddhism, you find that there is more than just this undifferentiated spiritual space in which nothingness exists and you dwell in a kind of white light nirvana. There's much more to the cosmology of Buddhism than first meets the eye. In this timeless place and space, one day the heavens were shaken by a resounding thunder, and the gods recognized that the suffering of mankind upon the earth was great. And so an appeal went out for one of them to become human and relieve their suffering. Svetakatu volunteered to become a Buddha and show mankind the way out of suffering. So just to telescope his biography a little bit, after countless lives and reincarnations, experiencing what humans experience, the Buddha was born into the Gautama family in the mid-6th century B.C., eschewing the pampered life that was doted upon him by his father, because it was prophesied before he was born that he would become either king of the world or an enlightened holy man who would relieve the suffering of many. And his dad said, well, given the options, I'd rather have my son become king of the world. I'd be dad of king of the world. That sounds a lot better to me. So he tried to direct Buddha in this direction. So he shielded him from all. So in effect then, Buddha experiences all of the pleasures and all of the riches, all of the pampering that life could offer. But instead, of course, Buddha becomes a wandering ascetic, begging for his food, learning the disciplines of meditation and contemplation. After mastering all of the schools known in his day of contemplation and ascetic life, meditation, he went and sat under a Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree is a sacred fig tree that's ubiquitous in the East, determined not to arise until he had achieved enlightenment. Now, in the statues of Buddha, the pictures of Buddha, they're invariably of him in a meditative state, perhaps just a sly grin on his face, under a tree. And that's the classic moment in the Buddha's life when he achieves endarkalment or enlightenment, to which all humans, all of his disciples aspire. Now, enlightenment, unlike the Western notion, one master complains that I checked out his website. He said, I'm tired of people coming here for a 3-day seminar and saying, Master, I only have 3 days. Can you enlighten me? In a 3-day seminar, right? Knowing nothing of Buddhism, that it is a lifetime commitment and that many never even achieve enlightenment, so to speak. Enlightenment is defined as that state of being where one achieves non-being. A state of being in which one achieves non-being. This is one of those contradictions by which Buddhists teach. They say that you cannot teach didactically Buddhism. You will never learn if you have a conceptual understanding of it without actually experiencing it. So they try to inculcate and lead you to the experience with various teaching means. One of these is contradiction, using contradiction. So you achieve a state of being, of non-being, in the sense where you transcend all human craving and desire and ignorance. The idea of transcendence, transcending the normal human condition. And in this understanding of enlightenment, there's no form of personhood in the way that we know individual personhood. Rather, enlightenment is this indescribable silence as the true answer to any question posed. Well, the Buddha's first words, let me cite, I'll sample once in a while the writings and the words of Buddha. His first words following enlightenment were, seeking but not finding the house builder, I traveled through the round of countless births. Here's the idea of reincarnation. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished too. Here's the idea. He has transcended the normal cycle of birth and death, the normal human condition. And then he goes on to say, my mind has now attained the unformed nirvana and reached the end of every kind of craving. This is the idea of cessation, the idea of the destruction of normal human cyclical existence. And so, thus Buddha achieved enlightenment, and upon his death, joined the ascended masters. Now, there are some ironies of Buddhism here as well. That is, Note with me, first of all, these masters are not gods in the traditional sense that religion knows gods, but they're nevertheless prayed to and revered. It's kind of like the Catholic system, where you pray to Mary or you pray to the saints, and they try, the Catholics with some fancy language, try to distinguish between praying to God and praying to the saints or praying to Mary. But the net effect is you're praying to Mary and the saints. And so it is. In Buddhism, they say you're not praying to God or gods, but in effect, in praying to these ascended masters, you're praying to these ascended masters for answers to prayer. Also, now while Buddhism insists it is learned through practice, never through didactic teaching, they nevertheless have their scriptures too. The Buddha Vakana, which is the word of the Buddha, divided into sutras or discourses. Also note with me, while ostensibly nirvana is a state of being, serene and silent and benign, unperturbed by human desire and passions, nevertheless, the heaven of the contented, when you study its cosmology, you begin to find, nevertheless, it's bubbling, it's percolating with a range of beings engaged in precisely the kinds of wars and passions, temptations, sufferings characterized in the human realm. Just like you find in the Greek panoply of gods. For example, ubiquitous throughout Buddhism is this character Mara, or the tempter, who goes around, he's kind of a devilish trickster, who goes around trying to discomfit the contented in their heaven and on earth too. Buddha was plagued with temptations from Mara. Even momentarily before his enlightenment, Mara was there trying to discourage him. So you find bubbling and percolating underneath the surface of all of Buddhism the same kind of passions and projected features of humanity projected upon the ascended masters in this whole realm. And then finally, note with me, while the Zen masters themselves are reputed to be kind and virtuous and compassionate, communicating the 10 transcendental virtues to their devotees, we don't have time to unpack the 10 transcendental virtues to which they aspire. Nevertheless, there's no transcendent God. Search Buddhism. Turn it upside down. You will not find the idea, the concept of an infinite personal God who desires a relationship with his creatures. But you won't find this infinite personal God from whom derives and originates these virtues. The virtues in Christianity are indeed discovered and found only because God has first revealed them, and he personally embodies, personifies those virtues as well, does he not? They're just there in Buddhism. All of this, of course, stands in stark contrast to the ascended Christ, infinite and personal, who now intercedes on our behalf, does he not? 40 days after his resurrection, he ascended to the right hand of God, where he now waits until his Father makes for him, his enemies, his footstool. But in the meantime, he intercedes on our behalf, the infinite personal God and his Son, indeed, calling to us, establishing life in us, and then taking us into relationship with him. And he will one day return. Stark contrast to the ascended masters, our ascended Christ. Well, secondly, note with me now, we ask of every religion, do we not? Not only who is it I'm worshiping, but we also ask, how am I saved? Point two. How does the noble eightfold path of salvation in Buddhism compare to the one path of Christ in Christianity? Anybody ever dabble with Buddhism? I did in my 20s when it first came over, really, from I mean, today we are surrounded by, especially we are swimming in a sea of Buddhism in the valley that we now live in. It's pretty shallow water, too, mostly. There are a few serious Buddhists who practice in our valley, but mostly it's the shallow Kurt Cobain kind of understanding of what Buddhism is. But if you've ever encountered a true Buddhist, oftentimes true Buddhists will go all the way. They'll have shaved heads and the saffron robes. We see them in airports once in a while. We look at them as pretty cultish, but they are practicing one of the four major world religions too. And we ask of every world religion, then how am I saved? And I think as you encounter Buddhists in your living, you will find it, and we really need to be armed with this ourselves in our own valley. Unlike Islam and so many other world religions, Buddhism does have a coherent and unambiguous answer to how am I saved. So we have to confront this. In the Buddhist understanding, there is much from which we must be saved, and there's a clear path to it. And Buddha was incarnate so that he might lead humanity in this. So there's a messianic quality to him. And it all begins with the four noble truths. There are four noble truths inculcated by the Buddha. Number one is the dukkha. The dukkha. That is the recognition that suffering is the central problem of human existence. If you don't understand this, you won't understand Buddhism. Suffering is the central problem of human existence. Not what causes it. They never get to the cause, that is the idea of the sinful human nature, that is our first parents, Adam and Eve, brought the house down, crashing down around humanity's ears, so to speak, in our nature, by sinning, and that we perpetuate this, not only through original sin, but the sins that we actually do commit as well, brings us into a state of sin and misery, as our standards call it. There's no insight into that. But they do understand that suffering is the central problem of human existence. The Buddha says, and I quote, "What now is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering. Decay is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates of clinging." What I've just articulated for you are these five aggregates of clinging. It goes back to the idea of craving, right? The five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Once again, no insight into the cause and God's solution to suffering, but indeed just a statement of the dukkha, that is, suffering is the central problem of human existence. Secondly, the second noble truth, samsara. Samsara, S-A-M-S-A-R-A. The cause of suffering is craving. That's the second noble truth. The cause of suffering is craving, not sin, but craving. That is, when one experiences the prospect of pleasure and enjoyment, it brings in with it this whole host of potential for greed and hatred, ambition, selfishness, vanity, pride, these kinds of things. I quote the Buddha again. "What now is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? It is craving, which gives rise to repeated existence." The cycles of birth and rebirth again, reincarnation, "is bound up with pleasure and lust," he goes on to say, "and always seeks fresh enjoyment here and there," that is, sensual craving, craving for existence and for non-existence. Once again, these opposition of ideas, this idea of contradiction, where you crave for existence and non-existence. Even the idea of craving non-existence is a craving and must be extinguished. Nirvana, extinguished. That is the third noble principle, and that is nirvana. That is, you can, there is a solution, there is an answer. You can transcend suffering. Nirvana, the third noble truth, is the transcendence of all suffering. Quoting the Buddha again, what now is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the complete fading away and cessation of craving. It's forsaking and abandonment, liberation and detachment from it, unquote. Nirvana. This is the Buddhist understanding of nirvana, not Kurt Cobain's understanding of nirvana. You can't take a downer and achieve nirvana. The fourth noble truth is arhat. Arhat, A-R-H-A-T. And that is the noble eightfold path that leads to deliverance. Here is the prescription, the solution, if you will, the answer for transcending suffering. It is arhat, the noble eightfold path that leads to deliverance. And it embodies itself eight factors grouped into three. I'll give you these. First of all, the first group of three is prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A, or prana, I'm sorry, prana. And it means wisdom in Sanskrit, wisdom. And under prana is two of the eight noble folds of the path, right understanding and right thought. So you have to get your head straight, as we might say in the West, first of all, with prana, that is wisdom, right understanding and right thought. The second of the three groupings is shila, S-H-I-L-A, which is morality. Under morality come three more of the noble folds of the path, that is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. See, these are the kinds of disciplines that Kurt Cobain was not willing to pursue in his so-called understanding of Buddhism. The third grouping is samadhi, which is concentration. Samadhi, concentration. Under these, the last three of the noble folds, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, this eightfold path is so poorly understood in the West, and this to the consternation of the true practitioners of Buddhism, because it involves a great deal of suffering and transcendence in terms of lifestyle, which most Westerners are unwilling to forsake. In fact, you think there's a lot of hypocrites in Christianity. Western Buddhism is filled with them. They'll go indulge themselves with a meal from the most expensive restaurant in town. I forget the name. Anyway, an Eastern restaurant in our locale, and then go out and meditate and complain about what's going on in the world and how nobody is achieving enlightenment. Well, you'll never achieve enlightenment at this pace yourself, hypocrite. Where the Buddha transcends his own suffering now in this eightfold path in order to achieve, and this is what he inculcates, this is what he teaches, and what he hands down to his disciples in Buddhism. What a sharp contrast, I submit to you, to Christianity's approach to suffering, huh? As we saw in Isaiah chapter 53. Where the Buddha transcends his own suffering in order to save himself, Christ embraces the suffering of others in order to save them. We saw in Islam where Muhammad sheds the blood of others in order to save himself, Christ sheds his own blood in order to save others. So here, In contrasting Buddhism and Christianity, the Buddha transcends his own suffering in order to save himself. Christ, rather, embraces suffering, does he not? Takes on suffering, the suffering of others as well, in order to save them. The scriptures are replete with this truth, are they not? The author of Hebrews is so eloquent on this. He says, "But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death." The suffering of death. He suffered death himself, embraced that suffering in order that he might save us. So that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone, the author of Hebrews says. The author of Hebrews understands this and expresses it so eloquently, doesn't he? "For it was fitting that he says, Christ, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For because he himself has, that is, Christ himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Christ indeed is a great intercessor because of it, because of his suffering, embracing that suffering rather than eschewing it, descending into it, into the heart of it rather than transcending it." So Jesus suffered outside the gate, author of Hebrews says, in order to sanctify the people through his own blood, suffering on our behalf, that he might make us holy, becoming sin for us. And as Peter expresses it so eloquently, "For Christ suffered once for sins, taking upon him the sins of the world, taking upon him the sins of his people. For Christ also suffered once for sins," embracing that suffering, going willingly, knowing exactly what he was going to go through for us. "Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous." Here's the idea of imputation. Indeed, he suffered having our sins imputed to him, and then his righteousness imputed in turn to us. "Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God." Here's that idea of the infinite personal God, unknown in Buddhism, unknown in Islam. I submit to you, unknown in every world religion as it's understood in Christianity. "The righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God," the Emmanuel principle. "Being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit." In the end, we find, and I'm afraid all Buddhists will find, just like Kurt Cobain, that Buddhism does not dispel illusion and delusion, but rather is yet another one of those mirrors of deception in the hall of mirrors, that is man-made religion. Man-made religion will never find God. It cannot. By definition, cannot find God. In the end, instead of transcending suffering, we can resonate with the impulse, can we not, to transcend suffering and to want others to transcend suffering, those that we love. Buddhism attempts to do that. But instead of transcending suffering in a state of nirvana, the soul that pursues Buddhism will discover all too sadly and probably all too late, like Kurt Cobain, that one has rather descended into the very state of eternal suffering. Ah, what a terrible and tragic irony that is. Just because you can deny suffering and put it at arm's length, and the most successful Buddhists are able to do that. In fact, Buddha went through all the sufferings of humanity and was able to have this benign smile upon his face and keep suffering at arm's length, even when he was suffering from physical pain and physical disease, those kinds of things, even though the Buddhist might be able to deny suffering and put it at arm's length, it is completely impotent to remove its cause and effects. Ignorant, deluded about the true root of suffering, that is sin. Unable, unwilling to admit that it is human sin, human nature, original sin, if you will, that causes suffering, brings us into a state of sin and misery, unable to do these things. Buddhism is. And if you don't treat the cause, you will not ameliorate the effects. And the effects, indeed, are eternal, brothers and sisters, for sin. So to all Buddhists, this is my appeal in the Teton Valley. Be in prayer for me as we do indeed make this appeal to our Buddhist friends and neighbors, finding ways to persuasively, graciously make this appeal to them. Join those of us who have come to God, who embrace the one who has embraced our sufferings, by embracing suffering, not transcending it, by going to the very heart of it, into the teeth of suffering on our behalf, in order that we might come to a living creator, to the one who has made us, to the one who loves us, to the one who indeed has prepared a place for us, that he might be with us. This one who, by not transcending death and suffering, but by embracing it, did it indeed for you. Know this to your soul, to your toenails, brothers and sisters in Christ, and pray that we can communicate that as well to our neighbors and friends where we live and where you live too. There are no doubt some Buddhists out there that you perhaps may know and may be able to better appeal to now on behalf of the Lord Jesus Christ. But let us now come to that place where we find all of this simply portrayed, the sufferings of Christ for our senses, in the body and blood of the bread and the wine of the supper of the Lord.